I did not only serve them soup, I also served them like kind of a like a psychological intervention from time to time.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to For the Curious and Confused, a podcast for people who want to understand different perspectives of the world through the people who inhabit it. I'm your host, Dominic Taggart, and today I'm joined by Danny Gottschalk. Danny is an interior designer and the founder of Tinseltown, a project development and interior design firm based in Camp Bays, South Africa. Danny is known for her bold, immersive interiors and her landmark project in Camp Bays, which recreates 1960s Palm Springs glamour with striking hues and retro Hollywood flair. With a unique background spanning marketing and psychology, her design spaces invite deep engagement and foster self-expression worldwide. I'm not very familiar with the ideas relating to interior design, so Danny, thank you for being here today to share your expertise.
Yeah, great. I'm looking so forward to that interview.
Indeed. So to start us off, could you give us first a 2-minute introduction into who Danny is and what motivates her?
Exactly. That's always like a good question. We have like a German, like a poet, and he's like, okay, he wrote a book saying like, "Who am I, and if how many?" So that's always like, okay. Am I what I'm doing? So, I mean, I'm an interior designer, but I'm also a psychotherapist. I'm a bar owner. Overall, I would say I'm a free spirit. Also, that's kind of a little bit overused term, but I'm basically a free spirit in everything I'm doing. And I'm like a truth searcher. So I'm looking for true self-expression wherever, if I'm like decorating a bar, a home, if I'm writing an article, or if I'm talking to people trying to help them in their psychological, their soul journey. I just try to seek truth and yeah, find the real authentic self-expression.
That's very important nowadays. I feel like there's a lot of conforming to some standards or another. So I really resonate with that. So if you were to divide your life into different chapters, what are some of the most important ones that we should know about in order to understand you better?
Well, I mean, of course, there's like childhood, which I do not have a lot of memory of. And I guess like childhood ended with 8 or 9, when my mom introduced me to basically everything a child should never hear about their parents' life. So, like intimate details and whatsoever. And I think that was the start of like problems I had, like psychologically and like growing up and being, I will not say confused, but, yeah, it just like changed everything. You get into puberty, you have too much information about your parents, your mom is always like downloading her problems onto you. You become the caregiver, you being parentified, you becoming your mom's mother and all of that. So that led to like, okay, I'm not really happy. I must do something against it. And I would say all that time till when I started receiving psychotherapy was 25, and then becoming a psychotherapist myself 10 years later. That can be divided in like the 10 years between 25 and 35 as, yeah, finding myself, going all ways psychotherapy has to offer, like trying to do as much as I can, getting all the help that I can, getting supportive of all on all levels, like spiritual, psychological, like everything that was out there. And in the then like was in the meantime of all that process, opening my first restaurant, 3 years later, opening my first bar. And then when I saw the process of becoming myself is final, becoming a psychotherapist as well with 37 or something. But it's still going on. I'm still going to therapy and I'm still giving therapy. So it's an ongoing process. So you start the journey with thinking, oh, hopefully that's soon over, but then it becomes your thing and your mission and your life, and actually quite normal because you keep on brushing your teeth every morning until you fall into the grave, and you should just like take care of your soul also every day. So yeah, and then ever since that, I would say since 40, another process like started of like buying houses and redecorating them, like re-renovating them and selling them, and now finally arriving in my dream destination in Cape Town. And buying and creating my masterpiece, which is called the Boho. And from here, it's basically, I still have my bar and everything, and I'm also still being a psychotherapist, but I would consider I'm now like an interior designer full time.
That's quite a journey. Wow. For the period you mentioned from about 25 to 35 when you had started doing psychotherapy, what kind of experiences or things were you doing in that 10-year period to, as you said, kind of discover yourself and tap into your form of self-expression?
I basically did every kind of therapy out there. I started like very classically with speaking therapy for 30 hours, and then of course felt a little bit better, but not so much. And then I did like a in English. Also, I'm like a German native speaker, but I had a sense of that I'm not staying in Germany forever. So I did in English like a Jungian dream psychoanalysis for 10 for 7 full years. But in between, I did everything from Reiki to breathing techniques to all kind of even like I'm also talking to mediums. I believe basically in everything. I don't believe that everyone has the gift. There's a lot of like smooth talkers out there, but there are people with gifts, and I received many blessings. But the most powerful thing I found was family constellation, which really like basically changed my life in one day. Like 7 years of Freudian psychoanalysis, nothing compared to an afternoon family constellation. Unbelievable. So I decided to become a family constellation therapist mainly. Because that's for me the most powerful thing for everyone. It has like also like something s a spiritual element to it, but it's a real therapeutic setting. But it's very hard to explain, though. That's why very many people are like, oh no, I'm not understanding it. I'm not doing it. I'm not surrendering myself to it. But if you surrender yourself to it, you will be like just blown away. And that really, really, I must say, turned my life around. I did not only do it once, I did it 500 times because I was in active education in it. But it's not always mind-blowing, but when it is, then it is. And I don't think any therapy can do for you what this can do for you.
I've never heard of that before. Is it, you say family constellation or consultation?
Yeah, it's not super popular. It's in some regions more popular than other, but it's rather that people say I never heard of it. It's like a group therapy thing where like you're not going with your family, but the people who are in the group representing people from your families. So you basically sit next to the therapist in a circle, and he will ask you what's your topic. And if it's like addiction or drugs in general, or the relationship with your mom or your dad, or that you always end up in abusive relationships, or if you are sick, whatever it is, your work environment, what's on your soul, that's exactly what is asked. So like and then sorry, there's a storm coming up. I quickly must close the window. Okay,
Oh, yeah,
sorry.
do what you gotta do. Yeah, no problem. No
It's
problem.
very unusual for here, hey.
Yeah, summertime is when the stores come
Super
and go just very
strange.
quickly.
Sorry for that. Super strange.
No
So,
problem.
the people in that group, they don't know nothing about you or your parents or your story. So it's actually really, really like a quiet process. But believe it or not, when you're standing there representing your mom or whatever, for example, which you probably not even know the name of, you start to feel something, not like massive stuff. But if you trust yourself and you're not too embarrassed to show it, you'll feel sadness or happiness, or you'll feel drawn to another person in the circle, or you will look in a certain directions, and they're like equivalents in that therapy. That's for example, like a mom will always stand in front of the child. If the whole constellation goes in a direction that the child isn't standing in the front of the mom, then you have been parentified. That's like a very clear and obvious basis. If someone is looking to the ground, he's like focused on someone dead. So if someone wants to leave the room, he's also drawn to he has suicidal tendencies. And there's like an expression kind of for everything, but the way the thing unfolds, it's just absolutely fascinating. It's about an hour, and you just have to watch it. You don't have to do anything, you don't have to say anything, and you can't look away. I mean, of course you can, but then you're not profiting. And seeing that in front of your eyes with people who have no clue and who don't want to harm you, or don't want to educate you about anything, or That's just mind blowing. And it's not always that strong. And sometimes you go out and say, I don't know really if this was for me. So, but most of the times it's amazing. And on some occasions it's just unbelievable. For me, it was twice unbelievable and really like a center turnaround in my life.
Oh, that sounds very impactful. Yeah, I can imagine that. I'm hearing a lot of kind of themes of like there are these sort of repressed emotions kind of within you that are hard to access, and in this setting, it gives you the space to let those repressed emotions kind of be known and be experienced more freely, which is very nice.
Exactly. It's absolutely beautiful, and a lot of you are crying, the people around crying, and you will see that a little bit of your story is like everyone's story. Everyone sees themselves a little bit in the other one, and you're not going out there and say like, oh, I have it pretty good. The other one is really fucked up. You know, it's like it's basically, hey, we what whatever we are suffering from, it's always the worst for us. We can't like focus on the poor children in Africa because we're not related to them. So our suffering is always the biggest one for us, even if it's compared to other sufferings, nothing. But for us, it will always be the worst, what we suffer from.
Yeah, it's always hard to hold both of those at the same time of like acknowledging that your suffering is real and valid while also not being the worst suffering possible as well. So,
Yeah,
so
true.
leading into some other stuff, how have your own personal strengths and weaknesses influenced your path and where you are now?
So this is really unbelievable. The world has gone down here. This is so unusual for Germany. Sorry. I think my weaknesses. I could be much richer, like in terms of money, at this point, if I would not have so much trusted the wrong people and gave away some of my power just to, I don't know, just to be nice or people pleaser or something like that, or just not to be confronted with the things I don't want to deal with. I mean, if you're so young and you open your own restaurant and someone comes along and they're like, oh, let me take care of your books and taxes, and you might be happy, you know? It's like, especially if it's kind of a father figure. But I found, so basically, there's always a price to pay. If people want to help you, it's mostly not very genuine. And in the end, you must really take care of everything yourself. So, I mean, I'm learned to not delay stuff. So if you have a business and you must deal with it immediately, it's not sitting on your head. It's not eating up your energy. You just like, there's a thing you hate the most, you do the first, and it's out of your sight, you know? So, but I'm like a completely, so I'm very like focused and I'm very clear. I don't have like black spots in me that I can't access. So I think that's my biggest strength, that whatever comes my way, I don't have to shy away because there's nothing in me which I'm afraid to face. And I think that opened me the most doors, that I saw I can't go there because that's one of my biggest fears. Besides me being very claustrophobic, which I do not have under control, other than that, I will always say like, no, I'm not afraid to do that. I'm not afraid to fear that, to face that. I'm not afraid to hold the hand of a dying person, even if I don't know it. So I'm not afraid to look at the worst. I'm not afraid. So I can attend everything because I can see it. I'm not taking it personal. People always say like, oh my God, that must be so depressing. Be a therapist and listen to all the sad stories of the people. I'm like, no, because it's not my story, and it's not that I'm cold. But I went through my own dark times and I know how to handle it. And I'm not taking on the other person's pain. I'm feeling for him, but I'm not like, it doesn't remind me of anything that's hidden in myself. So I think that's that you can only do when you have been there. Otherwise, you will never be able. I mean, people only meet you on the level that they met themselves. They will leave you and abandon you in your grief if they don't want to be reminded on what they're hurting.
That's a very true one. Yeah, of people only being able capable of meeting you where they've met themselves. You mentioned the not being afraid part. Is that something that you've always kind of innately had, or have you had to practice that in order to get better, or somewhere in the middle?
I'm not really like a courageous person. I would never like do bungee jumping or all of that. So I mean, I'm in that terms, I'm not courageous, but I'm courageous if it comes to taking responsibility for everything I do and everything. I'm also not afraid of money, but that's obviously not my topic in that world. Also, I'm not coming from like a rich family. I'm not afraid of money. If you, I'm not afraid. I would open like a hotel tomorrow in New York, and I wouldn't mind. So I have no relation to the money, because the money is also not what keeps me going. So it's coming in, it's coming, getting out. It's a substitute. I'm also not controlling my employees, because I think, well, if you steal from me, you go to hell. The money will come on from another side again, you know? So like I think like what's meant for me can't be lost. If you have good intentions, nobody can really steal from you. Nobody can create with by stealing your energy. It's just not possible, I guess.
You mentioned the money not being the reason you do it. So I think this is a good transition to the interior design. So when did you realize or learn that interior design and you mentioned hospitality also was important to you?
I think hospitality was important to me, because in my family it was always like, not because we were poor, we weren't poor, but my mom always only cooked for my dad, me, and that on her. So I could never have my friends staying over. My friends had always to go home. And in my friend's house, I was always welcome to like stay for dinner or whatever. And I found it just terrible. So I think, I always wanted to, I always loved to cook for people. I always loved to nourish people, maybe because I was so undernourished. But I think like food is like an act of love for me, and I love feeding people. And I mean, I opened a soup bar, which is in other parts of the world, a soup kitchen is for the homeless. And so mine was not for the homeless, but of course there also came people in that couldn't afford, and I did not only serve them soup, I also served them like kind of like a psychological intervention from time to time, where I was also thinking like, no, it's getting too much now, because you're like the person you are. You're an empath. You're like someone. I mean, I love to dig into other people's souls and then also really listen to them and give them advice. But sometimes it's too much. If you sell soup to 500 people a day and like 10 of them pour their heart out to you, it's already too much. It's like it's not worth the 5 euros of soup. So I thought like, no, let's get a diploma on it. So if it's getting too much for me, I can charge for it. Yeah, and interior design is like the step forward. So first it was a nurturing, and then it was like the creating was what it's there. It's basically like it's a reflection of the soul, the outside, and just like being able to create it in my own way. I mean, when you're depressed or whatever, or if you have psychological issues, you feel like you're like forced to live in the basically in your children room, where you grew up like emotionally and whatsoever. And if you see that you can create your whole life really yourself, you're grown up now, you don't have to stay in that apartment of your parents emotionally and internally and externally. So you can express yourself in a way that's much more you, and that mirrors you much more. And I think that's a lot, that like the mirroring isn't happening between the child and the parents. So like I love to create spaces that mirror me, and I mirror it back to them.
I feel like we're starting to get into some good stuff now. So for people who aren't as familiar with all of the interior design and psychology of spaces, I'm hearing a lot about having the mirroring of you and the space. So what are some of the other important ideas that really give that substance, like the importance of mirroring your spaces and being able to resonate with what you see around you in the space you exist in?
Yeah, I think it's like it's self-empowering to create your space yourself. Of course, you can also give your power to an interior designer. Good for me. And some people probably really don't have it in them, or they have too much other stuff to do. But in general, I would say like it's lovely if people discover what they really want, what they really like. And of course, also an interior designer can be there to suggest to them. And then they're suddenly like, oh, I love that, but I could never do that. And sometimes really like this, you see like a hot dress on another woman and you think I could never wear it, but probably you could, you know? So sometimes it's really not you, but sometimes it's you, but you're not bold enough because you probably have learn from an early stage, or one have told you you don't have the best taste, or that looks terrible, or whatsoever. And then it's kind of a confidence to know and to find out who you actually are, if it looks terrible, or if it's just you, and who the other person to judge, you know, even if it's Karl Lagerfeld. What does he have to say to you? You know, I mean, it's just like how much we value the taste of another person and how devalue our own taste for whatever reason. So I think to get some confidence and to go after what sparks joy in you, to find little pieces where you think, I really love that. And then, like, oh, but it doesn't fit in my apartment. No, it will. So get the stuff you really like, even if it's porn, and build the rest around it. And suddenly you will see yourself with different eyes. And that you feel like really like, I think so many people live in places that are not really their home. Where they do not really feel at home, where they like have like a normal solution like everyone. Like in Germany, everyone has IKEA. IKEA is okay, absolutely fine, but you in the end don't know in whose apartment you're living. If this is your personality, if your personality is exactly the same personality like your neighbor and your other neighbor, then I'm actually really sorry for you. And it's not even true, you know? It's just like, oh, I'd rather take this, or I'd rather buy the Polo Ralph Lauren shirt because I'm safe then, you know? Everyone knows it costs a fortune. I don't have to prove that I have taste. I'm good with that. So, and if I buy this, this is okay because my neighbor has it too. But what is it actually what you want? So do you want a life like everyone else? Do you really just want to fit in? Or do you have a style of your own because you live in that apartment all the time? You have to see all the time. It can stimulate and inspire you, or it can put you to sleep, or it can basically bore the shit out of you. It's your choice.
So to play devil's advocate for 1 second here, what do you say to people who say that interior design is just for people who have a lot of money and a lot of time to really curate their space in the way they want, but it lacks value for an everyday person? What would you say to somebody who says that to you?
I mean, I can understand that probably not everyone can afford it, but also, as I mentioned, I don't think it was on record already, but I mean, there will be people like me who do charity projects just to be able to put themselves out there and just like to create. But then also you don't have to have a completely empty house and give it over to an interior designer, and they do. I mean, of course, that's more for the rich people. But you can also say like, well, you do the living room, or you do parts of the living room, or I'm able to spend that amount of money and you give me some direction and the rest I do myself. I think value, it always has value because, I mean, not everyone, some people can't cook, some people can't really well decorate, some people, I mean, you get help in other areas of your life too, but imagining how much time you spend in your apartment or your house, you know, it's like people who don't want to invest in a mattress. Hey, you spent 33% of your life sleeping. Why would you sleep on a mattress that basically ruins your back, you know? I mean, it's just, you must just look what it means to you. And I think like some people can't tolerate clutter or maximalism, some people can't tolerate minimalism, but there's something in between that I think your home should have some personality. I mean, otherwise you would think you have no personality and there is just no person out there with no personality.
So for somebody who you mentioned IKEA earlier, somebody who has an apartment that's just full of IKEA stuff and is resonating with some of what you're saying, but doesn't really know how to start expressing their personality in their home, what sort of first advice would you give to start getting that self-expression into their home?
Well, I think also these people will walk around or see some Instagram reels or anything where they say, oh, that's a crazy painting, or this vase is insane, or something. Just start to get something that really excites you and not always put behind it, but that's not for me, or I can't afford it. Or, I mean, something that's really like like when you were 14 and you were going out for your at the first disco or for your first date, or where you have that feeling of something is actually tingling in me. So when I see that, that somehow sparks joy in me. Just get this and then watch it and see what it is doing to you. And if you find another piece, buy this. And if this never happens to you, if you just like have no intimate relationship with furniture or vases or whatever, and it doesn't trigger any feelings for you, then you just whatever, live with your IKEA furniture and I don't know. But I think for some people, they will have things. They will go window shopping. They will go through some newspapers or online magazines and see stuff that they adore. But they think that's so far away from what they have at home, they can't even get started. But I would say start with a lamp, start with a vase, start with anything. Start with anything you would say that doesn't fit into my apartment. That's perfect.
When you, I'm assuming you started doing this for yourself, when you started living by yourself, when you are finding those pieces, are you looking mainly in kind of like retail stores or thrift shops? Because I'm imagining some like more eccentric stuff being in like kind of secondhand stores and stuff like that. So what kind of stores are you getting a lot of your stuff from or encouraging people to get their stuff from?
I'm looking everywhere, and I say the experience in South Africa is very different from Germany because there, for example, like Marketplace is a big thing in South Africa, and I get a lot of stuff from Marketplace, which is cheap, and which then I will like kind of like I will paint it or I will spray it or I will do something with it. That's my artwork. But then again, I get other stuff from more exclusive websites. I get a lot of Jonathan Adler stuff. I have some sh shops of some designers I really adore, and I get all of that stuff in, but not too much. And then I also got like on, I even get stuff from Amazon. So, but you just have to have an eye for it. You can get stuff everywhere. I even try to pursue, I mean, I recently stayed in an Airbnb and they had chairs that were rotting on the terrace. And I'm like, please sell it to me. Just sell it to me. You can't, I mean, doesn't mean anything. They don't mean anything to you. They mean the world to me. We'll make them. They still haven't sold it to me, but I will give. They keep on pursuing it. So I get also. I do not even know what the name is in English, but from time to time, if you have like furniture in Germany, at least you can call the clear the they come the dustbin collection, but they get the bigger stuff. So everyone is putting their stuff out. And if you walk there in an upper class neighborhood, you will find the most amazing stuff. So I get it from everywhere. I'm not shy of used stuff. I'm not very much in antiques. I think they hold some sad energy for me most of the time. I think they hold all the stories of whoever owned them. But I get stuff from everywhere. And I mean, before I bought the house in South Africa, I already had a garage and 5 rooms in a cellar full of furniture because I already knew what kind of house I'm going to buy and how it has to look. So I bought the house for the furniture I had for the house I wanted to create. So I was storing them for 3 years before they got shipped over in a container to South Africa. And they came from everywhere.
So you're just always foraging around looking for stuff. That's a,
Yeah, I mean, I have so much stuff in my garage. I could immediately furnish 3 new houses. So they're just waiting for, because the idea is already in my head. So I would definitely try to sell that to my next client if their house, whatever kind of suits it. But yeah.
Wow. So with all of these projects going on and having enough furniture to furnish three other houses, what sort of experiences in these periods you've been talking about have been most formative for helping you define what success means for you?
Yeah, I mean, I do not even really know, but I mean, the most success is that I'm able to have and live and create the life I want to, where I'm not forced to work for anybody. I mean, I worked in an advertising agency, and it was pretty clear after 3 years that I can't do that. So, and I think I can never ever work for someone because, I mean, my ideas are just so strong, and nobody can talk me out of it. And I'm not willing to compromise anything because the other person is on a higher, he's a CIO and I'm just a copywriter. So it's just like, I know that this idea is good, I must do it. So it's just like this. And success is that I can do that now, so that I could interior design my own bar, my own restaurant. I can do my own printing campaigns. I can decide how I want to advertise, where I want to be advertised, how I want to spend my time, which projects I want to do, which projects I don't want to do. So that's my biggest success, and also get recognition. It was always important for me. That's also why I couldn't go to university after I graduated, because I never wanted to be like sitting with 400 other people in a room where the professor doesn't know my name. I always needed something there, like I needed an article in a newspaper where I could put my name under it and knew some people will recognize it. So I love it to be able to put something out there and people see it and they come into my bar and they, oh God, that's crazy. That's so Berlin, or that's so something. I love people's reaction.
I'm getting that vibe from you for sure. I get a lot of the you're gonna stamp your mark on whatever you touch. So in that time of doing all that, is there a lesson that you keep learning the value of over and over again?
Yeah, I think like my favorite sentence, not my favorite sentence, but one of my favorite sentences is like, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And it's not that I have to be reminded of that, because I think I'm always myself in every situation, but that's actually like so true for everything. So it's like, if someone you meet is messing up or overcharging you or coming in sloppy or coming in too late, it's kind of already over. You don't want to work with them. You don't want to engage with them. You don't want to make love to them. It's like basically, it is, you can't make up for that. So I think in 99.999% cases, you can't make up for that. And I think though, a first impression, I'm always surprised, even if I see a red flag in the first impression and I want to overlook it for whatever reason, it comes back. It's always right. The first impression is just always right.
That's interesting. I feel like that's one that I've over the years have heard a lot of back and forth on, as if like if the sometimes the first impression is, they had like a bad morning or something like that, and they end up being better down the line, yada yada. But I also see the value of what you're saying as well, and like having the trusting of your intuition on things as well. So I feel like that's one that's always up in the air a bit. But so you're in the camp of those always are telling you the truth.
I think if someone is aware of that he made a bad impression, if someone turns around after the first meeting or on the next day and say, listen, I was horrible yesterday, I'm totally aware of me, let me take you out for dinner or whatever, and then you see like a change in their persona. But most people just like, they just are that sloppy, and or they're not even aware of it. They never apologize for it, though they're not aware that they made a bad impression, and then they will make another bad impression.
That's a great caveat. Yeah, I feel like there are plenty of people who are just totally unaware that that even happened. So,
Yeah, exactly. So no, that's me. Take it or leave it. Yeah, I leave it. Thank you.
yeah. Oh, I love it. So what is I'm guessing you have a lot of these types of things, but what is something that feels like magic for you, either in your life or in your ventures of designing or anything that stands out for you?
In terms of designing, it's just like how much like something ugly and old can be turned around. It's just like, I mean, the house that I bought in Camps Bay, that's the best example for it. So the people, they built it in the 60s, they lived there, lovely family, but they never did anything to it. So the father's in a retirement home meanwhile, and the son lived there with his wife and his son. And they obviously, I mean, you get blind to it if this is your home where you grew up in, and I saw it, and it was really like from the pictures from the real estate agents, or the first eight pictures I saw, I'm like, no fucking way. So it's just like, it's like a toilet, yeah. So, but then I saw one picture and my mind started to spin. And it was really interesting that I have like kind of, I do not even know how to call it. I have like a photographic memory in terms of foreseeing stuff. So I don't need a computer program. I can absolutely take a snapshot and see how this will look in the end. So, and it definitely looks, and everyone who was participating in the renovation of that house, they were not sure what they were doing. They were like, okay, what that crazy lady wants us to do here. And but once the container arrived, and it arrived late, so once the container was there and everything was unpacked and everything was arranged, so people came in like, well, but it where was that yesterday? You know, in the end, it transformed very quickly because they didn't see it coming. They did not know what they prepared it for. They made a plain canvas, and then everything came in, and that's magic. But even more magic, I think, like how all things are connected. So how like the great collective subconsciousness works, how you can pick up on your dreams, how you can dream the dream at night from a person in the next room, how it counts that, I mean, they always say, at least in Germany, if there's a bag of rice falling in China, nobody cares. Actually, it does affect everything. So, or like even like an animal that is in pain and is wild and you decide to care for it. It will, if you can overcome your fear and care for it, it will turn to you. It will feel that you come in the best interest. It will surrender. And that's the most magic. All the unspoken words or energies that still come in, like the coincidences, the synchronicities, that's the most magic.
How do we align ourselves with that? Because there's so many distractions in the world nowadays that are taking our attention away. But how do we, from your perspective, get in resonance with that collective unconscious?
Yeah, I think it's important to block all that out, to limit your screen time, to limit did you not always have a background noise, that you not always, when you catch yourself of doing something all the time, scrolling, or you're actively searching for distraction. You know, I think people search for distraction because there's only one way. So distraction is away from you, and then there's focusing, which is towards you. But if you want to focus towards you must be aware that the first thing you will hit is pain and pain and pain and pain. So I think, yeah, working through that pain until you can sit still with what you're feeling. So because I think we are on so much distraction because we don't want to feel. I think distraction is like a feel avoidance. So like when you, for example, smoke, we say in therapy, you're opening up a side battlefield. And you know, when people smoke and they're stressed and they get confronted with a stressful situation, first thing they do, they lit a cigarette because that puts a distance between you and the issue. So, in everything we do, every distraction, every scrolling on Instagram, it is a distraction. It puts like a stop between you and the issue. But if you follow yourself, you get trapped in your thoughts, and you have an unpleasant thought, and then you grab a cigarette or a sip, or you put on YouTube or Instagram because you want to get away from that, and just to figure out the point you scare away from it. And instead of scaring away, stay a little bit longer, stay longer and longer and longer, and really follow your thought until you're at the source, because we're so unaware of what we're thinking and we're doing. And it's also natural to step away, or the people who always jiggle, who sit there and their legs are always like up and down and up and down and up and down. And that's like a dysregulated nervous system. That's like, okay, what happens if I force you to keep your legs quiet? What kind of emotions come up with you? So watch yourself intensely, and also ask other folks' opinions. What is strange or obvious in what is worse? Where am I trying to take a side turn, or where am I slipping out of the conversation? And then follow that route.
Sitting with the pain, being comfortable with discomfort, I think is kind
Yeah,
of what I'm hearing
exactly.
from you. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this has been a great conversation. To finish us off here, I'm curious if there's a piece of advice that is important to you, that you could leave us with.
Yeah, basically what I just said, you know, like always follow where it hurts the most. Always go for the direction where your biggest fear is or your biggest pain is. Don't avoid that because it's not for me, but I don't know who said it, but like the cave you fear to el enter holds the treasures that you're seeking, and that's absolutely true.
Yeah, that's a great one. I think that the current the current world view is often to just drop little bits of gold here and there and then lead you away from whatever that bigger treasure
Yeah,
is because you have
just
to get into the cave for
substitutes.
it. Yeah,
It's all
yeah.
substitutes, and it's all about how do I look on that picture? If I look happy on that picture and everyone thinks I'm happy, then I am happy. So, but it's not true.
Yeah, great things we can all learn from. Well, Dane, this has been a really good conversation. I really appreciate sharing some of your earlier life and your experiences with the different therapy types and views on interior design and just everything that you've been contributing so far. So, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was lovely.